From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer talks with us about the principles that guide him in interpreting the Constitution. He's written a new book called Active Liberty. We'll compare his approach to interpreting the Constitution with the originalist position of Justice Scalia, and we'll discuss how Justice Breyer's constitutional concerns helped him determine whether the Establishment Clause forbade two public displays of the Ten Commandments. Of course, there are some things he can't talk about, and he'll explain why. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from NPR member stations and Barnes & Noble, featuring Bob and Melinda Blanchard's Live What You Love, Notes from an Unusual Life, available in stores and at bn.com. Additional support for NPR comes from audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. And from the Ford Foundation, announcing winners of the Leadership for a Changing World Awards, honoring people inspiring change, online at fordfound.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. He was appointed by President Clinton in 1994 to the seat vacated by Justice Harry Blackmun. The new Chief Justice, John Roberts, is the first new justice since Breyer's appointment. Earlier in Justice Breyer's career, he served as counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee, spent 14 years on a federal appeals court, and was a professor of law at Harvard. The occasion for our interview is Justice Breyer's new book, Active Liberty, Interpreting Our Democratic Constitution. Justice Breyer, welcome to Fresh Air. I know there are certain things that Supreme Court justices are not supposed to talk about. So just kind of delineate for us, before we go any further, what are some of the things that you feel would be inappropriate for you to talk about in this conversation?
Cases that might come up, cases that were controversial in the recent past, other than the ones I went into in the book, anything to do with nominations, and probably there are others. Maybe that means the most interesting things to you I can't talk about.
Okay. Now, I was almost surprised that you had written a book, because I think it's kind of unusual for a sitting Supreme Court justice to write a book. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But why did you decide to write this book?
Some others have, but there were really two reasons. When I joined the court, and since then, I've learned from former Chief Justice Rehnquist, Justice O'Connor, Justice Blackmun, my predecessor, and others told me, and it's true, that there's a tremendous desire, I think, among many Americans to know more about the court. And that includes the heart of what we do, which is to decide very difficult cases. And I wanted to explain to people as best I can how I and maybe some others go about deciding those difficult cases. They'll then learn it's not the CIA, the Supreme Court. It's a public institution. People should know about it. The second reason is I think there tends to be a kind of misapprehension that people have. The misapprehension is that the Supreme Court decides what's good for people in the view of the justices. That isn't what we do. What we do is we take a constitution that doesn't tell people what to do. Rather, it sets out very broad boundaries. And within the space of those very broad boundaries, citizens, Americans, make up their own mind about how they want to live in society. And our job is really to police those very broad boundaries. We police the boundaries. We don't decide what people ought to do. Those are really the reasons to explain that I wanted to write something.
Now, what you're writing about in your new book is some of the principles that guide you in interpreting the Constitution. And you feel that the Constitution requires interpreting. And I think your approach is different from the, quote, originalist approach of Justice Scalia, and I think it's fair to say that he describes the Constitution should be interpreted literally, as close to the founders' interpretation as possible. And he has said the Constitution is not a living organism, for Pete's sake. It's a legal document, and like all legal documents, it says some things and it doesn't say others. Can you describe what you see the difference to be between that originalist view and yours when it comes to interpreting the Constitution?
Well, I'd preface what I'd say with emphasizing that I'm not writing this to reply to Justice Scalia, though he's written a book about the Supreme Court as well. And I'd want to add on that when I talk about the Constitution as creating democratic institutions, it's a special kind of democracy. It's the kind of democracy that protects basic human liberty, that assures a degree of equality, that breaks power down into pockets so that no group of people becomes too powerful, state, federal, executive, legislative, judicial, that creates a rule of law. That's the special kind of basic democracy that our Constitution sets up. Now, since that is, I think, what the Constitution says, and what I think the framers intended, in carrying out those basic underlying desires and purposes of the Constitution, I think others and those who think like me are carrying out the basic original ideas of the framers. If by originalism people mean specific ways in which those basic principles and word in the Constitution apply today in detail, I don't think the framers thought about the Internet. I think they drove to Philadelphia in horses and carriages, not automobiles. And thus, I don't say when I mean living Constitution, that doesn't refer to departing from what they wanted. It refers to applying the basic principle that they wanted to apply to the circumstances, which are often very different circumstances, that exist today.
And let me just add something you say in the book. You say, why would the framers who disagreed about the necessity of including a Bill of Rights in the Constitution, who disagreed about the content of that Bill of Rights, nonetheless have agreed about what school of interpretive thought should prove dominant in interpreting that Bill of Rights in the centuries to come? So you think that since the framers didn't even agree on whether there should be a Bill of Rights, they could hardly have figured out how we should be interpreting that Bill of Rights hundreds of years later?
I think they didn't really express much of a view about that. But also, I think that the differences in approach can be overblown. Most judges, probably all judges, who get into the business of interpreting the Constitution, and we do that more than most other courts. That's our job as the Supreme Court of the United States. But virtually all judges approach every difficult matter of interpretation, interpreting a text, and that is what we do, and they are difficult, with the same basic tools. What tools? A judge looks at the language. Of course, the language is relevant and sometimes determinative, but usually it's open. The language, the history of the provision, the tradition as to how it's been applied over time, the precedent, the basic purpose underlying that particular provision. Why is the word freedom of speech there? What does it mean? What does it refer to? What are the values and the consequences of an interpretation one way or the other, viewed in terms of the basic underlying purpose? Now, as I say, I think everyone, or almost everyone, uses those six tools. Now, where you get differences is that some judges want to emphasize more history, language, tradition, and others will emphasize more the basic values or purposes of the provision and look at the consequences in light of those values. I'd put myself in the latter category. I emphasize those things, and I think some others put themselves more in the former category.
My guess is Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. He's written a new book called Active Liberty, Interpreting Our Democratic Constitution. Let me ask you about the Establishment Clause. And the Establishment Clause says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, many people have pointed out that there's nothing in the Establishment Clause that says anything with the words separation of church and state in it. So how do you figure that notion of separation of church and state? Where does that fit? I mean, since it's not mentioned in the Constitution, do you use that phrase as a guiding phrase?
It's sometimes helpful. When we had two really, as I said, they're all difficult, the cases that come to us, and surprisingly perhaps to some, there's a lot to be said on both sides of these issues. And that's a very good example, the Establishment Clause. Same thing is true with the word freedom of speech. The same thing is true with the word liberty. In the constitutional phrase, nobody should be deprived of liberty without due process of law. Those words do not explain themselves. Where the matter is difficult, you have to go back to look to what would have been the underlying value or purpose or principle that those words represented. In the case of the Establishment Clause, my own view which I wrote a few pages about in a case involving the constitutionality of school vouchers, vouchers the government would have provided that you could have used in part for teaching at parochial or religious schools. In that case, I went into the history of it. And it seemed to me, anyway, that the basic value in part in that clause went back to the religious wars, the Protestants versus the Catholics in Europe in the 17th century, where they killed each other, murdered each other, had terrible, terrible wars, until finally they came to a truce. And the basic idea behind that truce was, I will be free to teach my religion, to practice my religion, to have my children practice my religion, and you will be free to do the same with yours. Now, that compromise suggests in the religious clauses of the First Amendment an object to minimize, to try to diminish, the terrible social dissension that can arise due to religious dissension. Today, we're a country not of one or two or three religions, but really of 50 or 60 different religious groups, and people feel very strongly about their own religion. Given that tremendous increase in the size of the country, the number of religious groups, the differences, it's particularly important to try to diminish the dissension that can arise out of those religious differences. So that, I thought, was one relevant basic purpose underlying the religious clauses, including the Establishment Clause.
You recently weighed in on two decisions regarding the Ten Commandments. One was pertaining to the Ten Commandments in courthouses in Kentucky, and the other was pertaining to the display of the Ten Commandments in the Texas Capitol. And you thought one was constitutional, the display in the Texas Capitol, and one was not, the display in the courthouse display. And you were the only justice to agree with the majority decision in both of those cases. Can you talk a little bit about how you arrived at your decision that one of these Ten Commandments displays was constitutional and the other unconstitutional?
Yes, from the tone of your voice, you may think, how could I have been so inconsistent to come out one way in one case with the Ten Commandments monument and the other way in the other case? It may help if I show you why I've explained what I think is the underlying value, the need to minimize, diminish social dissension based on religion. Keep that in mind. I did keep it in mind. And then I looked at the two examples. On the one hand, in the Kentucky case, it was a question of a monument that, given all the facts and circumstances, I thought one could conclude was being put into the courthouse primarily for religious purposes. And in doing that, I thought there is a risk of the very kind of dissension based on religion, religious purposes in the public place, that the Establishment Clause is there to prevent. In the other case, it was a Ten Commandments monument that had been on the Texas State Capitol grounds for 40 years. No one had objected. It was therefore with about 17 or 18 other monuments that had purely secular purposes. It was there to illustrate the ideals of the people of Texas. There was so little that showed a basic religious function, a primary religious purpose, that I thought that one is probably all right, particularly since to strike it down could have led to an effort to chisel Ten Commandment displays off of public buildings throughout the country. So to have, on the one hand, people try to put up religious monuments directly and deliberately to encourage a particular religion, and on the other hand, to go around and start chiseling off of public buildings monuments that did depict the Ten Commandments. Both of those things, in my view, could have promoted the very kinds of dissension that the Establishment Clause is there to stop, namely social dissension based on religion. And therefore, it seemed to me that neither does it require chiseling the monuments off of the building, nor does it allow, deliberately for primarily religious reasons, erecting a religious monument in a public building. And that's why I said the Kentucky display, which was an example
of an effort to promote religion through a new monument was forbidden, and in my opinion, leaving the display on the Texas ground, which had been there for 40 years, was permissible.
My guest is Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. He's written a new book called Active Liberty, Interpreting Our Democratic Constitution. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. I'm very grateful that when I interview someone like Justice Breyer, I don't have to limit our conversation to sound bites. Public radio isn't about sound bites. We're able to provide a forum for thoughtful, in-depth conversations. Your station is fundraising today. I urge you to support it with a pledge to keep alive this forum. Thank you. My guest is Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. He's written a new book called Active Liberty, Interpreting Our Democratic Constitution. Let me ask you about another question pertaining to religion and public life. And this gets to Article 4 of the Constitution, that no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office. Do you feel that that there are times in public life today when that is being breached, when there are religious litmus tests that people are using?
You want to know, you see, this is why it's so depressingly difficult an interview for you, because really, you really want to know, is what do I as a Supreme Court justice think about an instance that you have, which is a very interesting kind of instance that's in your mind that you think might violate the Constitution? Well, one of the reasons I'm under an ethical constraint not to talk about that kind of thing is that whatever the rules of ethics are, they wisely warn me that it is very risky to start talking about legal matters that I haven't thought through. And I haven't thought through that one, and I don't really know, and I can't discuss it anyway for very good reason.
Now, while we're on the subject of what you can and can't talk about, and I don't know if you can talk about this, but when you were going through your confirmation hearings for a Supreme Court justice, how did you draw the line between the questions that you felt you could respond to and those that you felt would be inappropriate for you to respond to?
Probably pretty much the way I'm doing it now. I think most people have explained, because many people watch those confirmation hearings who aren't lawyers, who aren't intimately familiar with the codes of ethics. And I think I said that there are a couple of reasons why you shouldn't talk about future matters that can come before you. One reason is because if you were a litigant, you wouldn't like to have a case before a judge who, in a legislative forum or outside of the courtroom, had taken a view in a matter that he had not yet decided as a judge. You'd be worried that instead of paying attention to the legal argument, he would want, or she would want, to just validate what he said before. But the primary reason is how often I've learned, as a judge, that my view is expressed at a cocktail party or among friends is one thing. And then after I read the briefs, think about it, hear the oral argument, talk to my colleagues, it can be quite a different thing. The decision there is for real. It's not just something you happen to think of at the top of your head. It really matters. And that, I've learned over time, can be a very different view than what I thought at the cocktail party. Maybe I now think something different after I've been educated.
Now, you were interviewed for the justice position by President Clinton. This is for the position that Ruth Bader Ginsburg got in 1993, but she ended up getting that position. And then in 94, when another seat opened up, you were nominated by President Clinton for that. What was the vetting and confirmation process like from your point of view? Here, it's a time when you are so out there. I mean, when everybody, you know, the judiciary members, the press, everybody's looking for everything they can find on the nominee. Was that a difficult time? I mean, is it a very uncomfortable process to go through?
Let's not. I'd say this, I've used this metaphor before too, which is trust, that asking about the confirmation process, the appointment process, asking me that is like asking the recipe, the recipe from Chicken a la King from the point of view of the chicken. I didn't do the appointing and I didn't do the confirming. I was asked a lot of questions and it was stressful. Of course it's stressful. There's 17 senators at that time on one side of the table and me on the other side. And people are watching on television. I think luckily I was sort of boring and they began to turn it off. That didn't bother me. But certainly it's stressful.
Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer has written a new book called Active Liberty, Interpreting Our Democratic Constitution. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, what it's like working on the highest court in the country and being its junior member. We continue our conversation with Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. He has a new book about interpreting the Constitution called Active Liberty.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Alzheimer's Association, advancing research, providing care and support services, and promoting healthy brains at alz.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. He's served since 1994, when he was appointed by President Clinton. The occasion for our interview is Justice Breyer's new book, Active Liberty, Interpreting Our Democratic Constitution. Justice Breyer, you've been the junior member of the court since 1994, when you were appointed. And although Chief Justice Roberts is the newest member of the court, I think as Chief Justice, he's kind of preempted from being considered the junior member. So are you still the junior member?
Yes. And but I get one vote, just like everybody else.
What are
I
some
say that with a smile, too, because it, being junior justice, what does it involve?
Yes.
What it involves is when we're in conference by ourselves, we almost every week or most weeks we're in conference and we discuss the cases by ourselves in the conference room. We sit around a long, pretty long table, and the discussion goes around in order, and there's no one else in the room. And if someone knocks on the door, I open it. That's what being junior justice involves. And they might have papers. Occasionally somebody knocks. Which was rather funny. We get on very well in the conference, by the way, but someone knocked a couple of months ago, and this was unusual, that they had some coffee for Justice Scalia. So I brought him a cup of coffee, and he said, "Well, you've been doing this for some time, haven't you?" He thought that was funny. And I said, "Yes," I said, "and I've gotten very good at it." And he said, no, you haven't. No, you haven't." So, I mean, it's fine. It's not a problem. I enjoy it. And that's what it involves. I also report to the clerk's office the result of the votes on the petitions for certiorari and other matters.
So, you know, in most...
I'm last in a line. If there's a line for the cafeteria or whatever, I'm last. That's all right. I don't mind.
This is the only part of the Supreme Court that sounds a little bit like high school.
High school wasn't so bad.
You know, in a lot of places, it would be the intern who gets the coffee, but I guess there aren't, you know, interns or anybody else allowed in at the conference of the Supreme Court.
That's true. The conferences are efficient, and we discuss the matters that came up, the cases, what cases we're going to grant, what petitions we're going to grant, a few other matters, and the discussion is... very orderly. It usually proceeds first with the Chief Justice, and then in order of seniority, Justice Stevens, O'Connor, Scalia, Kennedy, Souter, Thomas, Ginsburg, and me. And then after everybody's had a chance to speak once, people might speak twice, and they might go back and forth somewhat. The rule that nobody speaks twice till everybody speaks once is a very good rule, I think, for every group. I'm last, you know, so it benefits me. But it really promotes good feeling within the group. The key to that conference, I've always thought, is that people are not arguing with each other. They're stating their true reasons as to why they reach the conclusion they do. And as long as people are talking about their true reasons and not making an argument, "I have a better argument than you, ha, ha, ha," as long as it doesn't proceed like that, but you're stating the true reasons, you can have a fruitful discussion. Because then someone else can say something that's directed to a point that's meaningful to the first person who first spoke. I've never heard a word in that conference. I've never heard a voice raised in anger, despite the strong feeling on many, many issues on both sides.
How often would you say opinions actually get changed at that conference?
Opinions are often shaped. The shape of the opinion... that eventually emerges. The discussion leads, everyone's taking notes about it, what everyone else says, and the discussion will shape the opinion that eventually emerges. And as to whether how often people go in thinking A and they come out thinking B, the right answer to that is sometimes. Not too often, but sometimes. Over time, I think I have an idea of how I make up my own mind and how people make up their minds about things. Do you want me to go into that?
Sure.
What you think when you have a tough decision, or any of the listeners. I think when we have a tough decision and you're trying to organize it formally, it isn't that you have no view as to the outcome. I find from the moment I open the brief and see the question, I have a view. But I'll read the brief on one side. It's like the old joke. You read the first brief, you say, "Well, he's right." Then you read the second brief, you say, "Well, he's right." Then somebody says, "They can't both be right." And you say, "Yes, that's right." You know, it's your view shifts. It's a continuous work in progress. You're keeping yourself held open. You're purposely, I am and others are, purposely trying not to make a final decision until all the information is in. And then occasionally, after the conference, opinion drafts are written, they're circulated, there are dissents circulated, and sometimes the court shifts. We call it the court flips sometimes. Not too often, but sometimes. Then the decision comes down. After it comes down, what do most people think? In a really hard, close case, I don't think. It was so close, I'm probably wrong. I think it was so close, I'm glad I got the right side. And then over time, I might think, well, it was not quite as close as I thought. And over time, you begin to think, my goodness, how right I was. Now, I know that isn't always true, but that's psychology. That's human psychology. That's human nature. And that means, as a practical matter in our court, once we finish one difficult case, we're on to the next. We're very future-looking. We don't go back and think, oh, dear, oh, how awful, and mull around. Normally, you just think, well, I think probably I made the right decision. Anyway, I did my best, and on to the next one.
I don't know if you could talk about this, but has there been any decision that particularly weighed on you, that you had a very difficult time figuring out where you stood on it?
They don't classify or break down in my mind by that highly personal thing, because many of them are quite difficult. I do tend to think in terms of importance. I think, for example, a very important decision I participated in was the affirmative action case, which was a difficult case that came out 5-4 to say some affirmative action is permitted under the Constitution. The Constitution does permit some. I think that was a very important case. I mean, there are others. There are others that stand out for their importance.
Well, with affirmative action, if you felt like it was difficult to figure out what your opinion was going to be, was there a kind of key bit of information or a key part of your thinking that your decision finally turned on?
Well, I think that in that case, I write about that case in this book. I write about it because I think it illustrates something. I to go back to the basic thesis is that we're the Constitution creates a certain kind of democracy with the parts about democracy. It's a democratic institutions of a certain kind, protecting fundamental liberty, a degree of equality, separation, division of powers, rule of law. I want to say that that isn't just a 4th of July speech. That those things, and particularly I emphasize, though it's by far it's not the only thing in the Constitution by any means, but I emphasize the democratic part, the part of creating an inclusive democratic society. Now in the affirmative action case, the particular constitutional phrase at issue was the 14th Amendment phrase that no state shall deprive any person of equal protection of the law. What do those words mean, equal protection of the law? One group of people think that they mean the Constitution and the laws, including laws affecting universities, must be absolutely colorblind. Nothing negative on the basis of minority status, nothing positive. Absolutely colorblind. There are others who think, no, if we go back to the purposes of that 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause, we'll see that it was designed to take people who had previously been in slavery and try to help bring them into the mainstream of American society. That was its basic function. And that means that laws that treat the minority group negatively are worse than laws that treat them affirmatively, because the affirmative laws are trying to further that basic purpose. That doesn't mean they're all constitutional, but it means there is a difference. Now, I promise you that there are good arguments for both those positions, the colorblind position, the purposive position. And one of the difficult tasks of the court in that case was to choose which interpretation. Now, throw into that mix a basic constitutional purpose to create participation by Americans in a democratic society. And ask yourself which of those two interpretations is more likely to further that democratic purpose. One that seeks to include minority groups, or others that would, as businesses told us, the military told us, unions, universities, all told us in briefs, that if you have a colorblind interpretation, if we cannot make some small effort on the affirmative action side, if that first theory prevails, we cannot run our institution very well. Too many people will feel excluded. Well, I think that helps. It helped me, and it helped the court, because that's what they wrote in the decision. That's what Justice O'Connor based in large part her decision upon. The fact that the Constitution is inclusive, that its basic purpose is to bring people into a democratic political process, and that helps show that that purposive interpretation is, I think, the one that is constitutionally correct. Right. Now, you see, I'm trying to show you how the basic democratic goals of the Constitution can help, not dictate, but can help a judge reach a constitutional decision, even in a different area, in a difficult case.
My guest is Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. He's written a new book called Active Liberty, Interpreting Our Democratic Constitution. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. His new book is called Active Liberty, Interpreting Our Democratic Constitution. You are a Supreme Court Justice during a time when the expression activist judge has been used a lot, and I wonder what that expression means to you and how you what the impact of people using that expression is on justices like you.
Well, people mean different things by it. It's never a compliment. I think it's normally sort of insulting. Interestingly enough, I think the phrase originated in an article that Arthur Schlesinger wrote about the court that Truman and Roosevelt had appointed, those presidents, President Truman, President Roosevelt, in 1947. And there were some people that were criticized as having just substituted their views of social justice for the law. And then there were others like Frankfurter and Jackson who said it's very important not to do that. Our job is to interpret what Congress wanted, not to substitute our own views. Both sides were reacting against the pre-New Deal court that had been criticized a lot for striking down New Deal efforts. Now, today, I think it's fairly universal. The judges would say, of course, what we're trying to do is we are trying with a statute to interpret what Congress wanted, not our own views. And so in terms of intent, you could say, well, we're all non-activists now in that respect. Sometimes the word activist has been used to talk about remedial programs such as went on after the segregation decision, desegregation, Brown, where there were schools, mental hospitals, sometimes prisons that came under judicial decree. I think there that isn't a concurrent problem because Congress has remedied many of those situations, and they needed remedying. And it's not at all surprising that there had to be strong remedies after Brown versus Board of Education, because had there not been an effort to make strong remedies, nothing would have happened. There wouldn't have been desegregation. And then sometimes people use it to refer to how the extent to which a judge defers to Congress, is reluctant to strike down a statute of Congress. Are we reluctant to strike down a statute as unconstitutional? Do we defer to the will of Congress? Do we try to make that statute constitutional? Do we try to avoid striking it down as unconstitutional? And if that's the meaning, well, the statisticians who've looked into it seem to say the ones who are defer the most to Congress are Justice Ginsburg, Justice Stevens, and me. So it's pretty hard to say now what this activism means, except that we're against it. We think judges, everyone thinks that judges have to, they have to follow the will of Congress. That's the object. And the word's still used, but you'd have to ask the people who use it what they mean.
My guest is Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. He's written a new book called Active Liberty, Interpreting Our Democratic Constitution. We're living in a very politically divided country now. Do you feel the impact of that division within the court? It always seems from the outside looking in that the court is pretty divided, too. But, you know, do you feel like those divisions in the court or what's been called the culture wars, do you feel that in the court or do you feel insulated from that?
It is something of an ivory tower, and we do get on well personally, and people do have different views. As I said, I grew up at a time when Franklin Roosevelt and Presidents Roosevelt and Truman had appointed every member of the court, and when I was in high school, it probably seemed natural that Democratic presidents would appoint every member of the court. But that's not the system. What the Constitution creates is a system where, through life tenure, different presidents, probably from different political parties, will appoint different members, and all that those presidents think that their appointee is always going to vote the way they think would be right, they're in for a surprise, because justices don't. Teddy Roosevelt appointed Oliver Wendell Holmes. He decides the first antitrust case in a different way, and Roosevelt says, I could appoint a judge with more backbone carved out of a banana. He was pretty annoyed. Well, still, presidents may try to appoint judges who share a kind of basic philosophical outlook about the role of law in American life, how it relates to people, and there they may be more successful. So inevitably there will be people of different points of view, and that's good. That's not bad. We're a big country. There are close to 300 million people. I'm sure you do have an idea of how many different groups there are, races, religion, points of view. My mother used to say, you know, there's no point of view so odd that there isn't somebody who doesn't hold it in America. And anyway, you understand the point. With a country like this, it's really wonderful, it's wonderful that all these people have learned how to get along. I see that in the courtroom every day. I see that every day, that they've learned how to resolve their differences under law and not in the streets with sticks and stones or worse.
Justice Breyer, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer has written a new book called Active Liberty, Interpreting Our Democratic Constitution. This is Fresh Air. Because public radio is not ruled by commercial concerns, because we don't have to please advertisers, we're able to provide long, reflective conversations with some of the most important people of our time, like Justice Breyer. Today, your station is fundraising, so it's your chance to make sure your station can continue to bring you the national and local programs that you've come to appreciate. So please, call now with a pledge. Thank you. On Monday, the cable channel Turner Classic Movies begins a week-long Alfred Hitchcock Festival, and a new boxed set of digitally remastered versions of Hitchcock films is now available on DVD. Called Alfred Hitchcock, The Masterpiece Collection, it features 14 of the English director's films, including Shadow of a Doubt, Rear Window, Vertigo, Psycho, and The Birds. Checking out the set, our critic-at-large John Powers started thinking about Hitchcock's enduring appeal and why his popularity continues when so many other big Hollywood names have lost their luster.
Alfred Hitchcock was the first movie director I ever knew was a movie director. And I knew it because he made me. Long before self-help experts wrote books about the brand of me, Hitchcock was busy marketing himself. He walked into his well-known silhouette on TV's Alfred Hitchcock Presents, and he turned his movie cameos, which he began in 1927, into a ritualized delight. I remember watching The Birds and my mom happily saying, "There he is," as the manatee-shaped Sir Alfred left a pet shop with two white terriers. Hitchcock's iconic status has only grown in the intervening years. A quarter of a century after his death, he's the lone filmmaker famous before 1950 who still looms large in the popular imagination. Even young people who shun old movies put Hitchcock in the DVD player because they know that his movies are going to be fun. Hitchcockian. No intellectual, Hitchcock never had much interest in the outside world. He had little to say about society, history, or politics, as a duff spy movie like Torn Curtain made abundantly clear. But Hitchcock did something better than pontificate about politics. He filled his work with indelible images and vivid conceits. All his good movies contain something unforgettable: the crop duster sequence in North by Northwest, the gulls slowly accumulating outside the schoolhouse in The Birds, the glowing glass of milk in Suspicion, the tennis match in Strangers on a Train when every spectator's head moves but Robert Walker's, and the idyllic small town that harbors evil in Shadow of a Doubt, Hitchcock's personal favorite among his own films, and an obvious precursor of things like David Lynch's Blue Velvet and Twin Peaks. Not all his movies were hits, of course, but even at his worst, he was a masterful stylist, almost Flaubertian in his precision. In fact, his sense of composition and rhythm were so immaculate that he barely needed dialogue. Some of his greatest sequences are hypnotically silent, like Jimmy Stewart raptly following Kim Novak around San Francisco in Vertigo. Nobody has ever been so good at creating a pervasive mood of suspense, at once unsettling and seductive, in part because the menace is shot through with a droll sense of comedy. Here, for instance, Anthony Perkins's Norman Bates is having dinner with his future shower stall victim, played by Janet Leigh, right after an argument with Mother.
You eat like a bird.
You'd know, of course.
No, not really. Anyway, I hear the expression "eats like a bird." It's really a falsity, because birds really eat a tremendous lot. But I don't really know anything about birds. My hobby is stuffing things, you know, taxidermy. And I guess I'd just rather stuff birds because I hate the look of beasts when they're stuffed. You know, foxes and chimps. Some people even stuff dogs and cats, but, oh, I can't do that. I think only birds look well stuffed because they're kind of passive to begin with.
Good stuff. Yet it's worth noting that Psycho was the father of today's slasher movie. With its dazzling cutting, in both senses of the word, the shower scene brought a new level of violence to the screen. And this was not accidental. Because his own psyche was haunted by fears and repressed desire, he was notoriously hot for and cruel to his blonde leading ladies, he passed that emotional violence on to the audience. Where great Hollywood directors like Ernst Lubitsch, Howard Hawks, or George Cukor appealed to our sense of freedom, playfulness, and emotional generosity, Hitchcock was all about manipulation. He liked to work audiences over. And at this, he was peerless. His thrillers are thrilling in part because they're sheer torture. Is there any more disturbing film music than this phrase from Bernard Herrmann's famous score for Psycho?
Oh!
hearing that again, you can understand why Hitchcock still feels so current. His best work captures the paranoid assaultiveness and psychological instability of modern life. In fact, Hitchcock revels in such things, as other great filmmakers never do. Part of his enduring power is that his brilliance so often appeals to what's cheapest in our sensibility, our love of sensation and fascination with violence. What keeps this from being abhorrent is that Hitchcock seemed to know it. More than any other Hollywood filmmaker, he was attuned to the psychological dimensions of watching, especially while sitting in a movie theater. Even as Rear Window and Vertigo are brilliant explorations of the internal process of film-going, with its voyeurism and crazy psychological projections, North by Northwest is a magisterial confection that's at least partly a postmodern riff on the audience's whole idea of Cary Grant, who cruises through the movie like a yacht. Some people make slices of life, Hitchcock famously claimed. I make slices of cake. This is certainly true, and I, for one, will keep devouring them on DVD. Still, one should never forget that Hitchcock's cakes are laced with strychnine and frosted with blood, and that the taste for such tidbits is not altogether good for you.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and the author of Sore Winners. The Alfred Hitchcock DVD collection was released by Universal Studios Home Entertainment. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The new film Shop Girl stars Steve Martin. It's based on his novel of the same name, and he co-wrote the screenplay. On the next Fresh Air, we feature an interview with Steve Martin. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.